My name is Howard Olson. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm a forestry graduate and have been interested in conservation matters during my entire career, but I did get into field forestry. I have been in the chemical industry all of my career for 35 years in what they call wood preservative chemicals. My primary product was pentachlorophenol. Contained a lot of dioxins, so for the last year, 8 years, I haven't been in that business. I've been coming to Holden for off and on for 25 years, I think, and was on the board at one time, and presently I'm on the Science and Technology Committee, and I've always enjoyed all of my associations with Holden very much. My wife's name is Betty, and she's been the artist in residence at Holden from time to time. I found in leading discussion groups at Holden that it's much easier for all of us if we know who else is in the room. And I do this also out of a selfish motive for myself, because I don't want to get caught short if some super scientist is in front of me and I'm trying to act like I know what I'm talking about. So Glenn is going to help me a little bit today in a session, and also Rick in the back on geology and on physics. So let's start with you, Glenn. Just give your name, where you're from, what your interest in this subject is, and you tell us how many times you've been to Holden if you want to.
Well, my name is Glenn Mobleson. I'm from Los Alamos National Laboratory. I'm also on the Science and Technology Committee. I've been involved in fusion energy research for 15 years. My background is in astrophysics and physics. My interest in Holden goes back to 1985. I've been here every year since 1985. I consider this is just another area of my concern about the relationship with the image of God, the relationship between man and earth, sun, earth, and man, sun, earth, and life, and the intricate interaction that goes on. Some people have understood, the Indians in particular, I think, understood it very well in one sense, and we've kind of ignored that, the American Indians, for example.
Okay, so, well, we'll just go around and we'll come back.
Some of us have differences of opinions on some of that, what you said, so.
Sydney Mickelson from Dallas, Texas.
Dallas, Texas.
And this is the second time.
And Kermont Mickelson, we're both from Dallas, yeah.
What was your profession?
And I was in petroleum exploration.
Okay, good.
Janice Simon, I teach in children in Minnesota. I'm an elementary school teacher. Fourth time I've been to Holden.
Good.
I'm Mark Adams. I've been with Holden Science and Technology Committee since 1978. And so I've been up here quite a number of times. I was on the faculty at Washington State University for 33 years before I retired in 74. I was heads up the materials chemistry section in the Division of Industrial Research.
Okay.
I never did any formal teaching.
Irene Heinemeyer from Reno, Nevada, and this is my third time here, and I'm interested in the subject just as part of being a steward of what God has given us.
Jim
Heinemeyer, Lutheran pastor from Reno, Nevada, and I view this as caring for our mother.
Good.
I'm Al Oscar from Reno, Nevada, and I'm here just as an interested citizen in the subject.
Okay, Lola?
Lola Oscar from Reno, Nevada, and nature's always been a big thing.
First trip to Holden?
First to Holden.
Okay.
I'm Chuck Roth. I'm from the LA area, Southern California. I'm a manager of Advanced Product Concepts at Xerox Laser Printers. I'm interested in the whole subject of ecology.
Good. You, ma'am?
Well, I'm Helene Bourbon from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, First Lutheran Choir. I've sung since about 50 years, and I taught 50 years ago. 52 years ago, I taught, and I have six children, and they have such varying interests that they've all gotten me bone to the fact that I must find out more about what's going on.
Good. You're in the right place today. Rick?
I'm Rick Dunning from Northfield, Minnesota, a geographer and a geologist by trade. teach both of those subjects on the college level. And I'm here at Holden and working up in the Portal Museum.
Richard Bond, I've been here half a dozen times since 1978. And I have an engineering degree, but operate a pipeline building business. And I'm just a long time interested person in
good.
Ecology.
I'm Ken Langrack. I'm a corrections officer currently. As far as science background, I've had some college, and I also did some sophisticated work in the military on a technical basis.
Thank you.
I'm Larry Dio. I just graduated from Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, and I'm starting medical school in Seattle in the fall at UW, and just kind of interested in the subject. In fact, I just hiked in here today.
Good.
I'm Georgie Bailey from Bellingham, Washington, and I've been to Holden maybe 8 times. I'm a seafood inspector for National Marine Fisheries, but I would be interested in the subject anyway.
We met a fellow last night that did research on one of the boats and said he was counting fish and doing color research. He sees them before you do, I guess.
Dennis Bailey from Bellingham. I teach middle school science.
Okay. Back there, Augustana.
Augustana. I'm Paul Olson. I teach African American literature at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois.
Okay.
Hank Powering. I was an elementary teacher and then, for 5 years and then finished up my 30 years in physical education.
Where are you from?
Norman. And basically, yes.
Yes, I'm Darlene Pomeroy. This is our first time here, and I'm a second grade teacher, and I would like to stretch myself so I can stretch my children.
Good. Rudy?
I'm Rudy.
There's no introduction.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Now, I'm a geologist by trade, but retired. I'm retired from everything, so I'm here.
Okay, we've got a few people upstairs here, so...
I'm Brenda McMahon, and I'm from Cottage Grove, Oregon, but I've been living here since early last August, and will leave this August, and I've just kind of been interested ever since I did start to care for creation.
Good, Brenda, thank you.
Yep. I'm Jill Smith. I'm living in Portland, Oregon now. I've been holding on and off about 6 times since 1975, and I'm a reporter, and I write on natural resource issues.
Oh, good.
I'm Mary Swenson, and I'm on volunteer staff, and I got a half-time position carrying on health issues work, so I'm with the Holden Care for Creation Task Force.
Good.
My name is Wayne Cross. I come from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I work for the natural gas pipeline company in British Columbia.
Oh, good. You make us international. And you, would you like to introduce yourself? What's your name?
Okay. My name is
Mitsuyo
Shimada, and I'm from Japan. I just come here.
Well, good. We're glad to have you.
And I'm going to work here as a visualizer.
Masio is here for 3 weeks, and she is going to, you see her running around as a waitress.
Okay, very good. I'd like to set the tone for today's meeting because so much has been written and spoken of how we are decimating Mother Earth or our Earth in double time. So today we'd like to take another tack and think for the next hour or so on the magnificence and the miracle of God's creation, His natural resources, and since it's Science Week, emphasis on science at Holden, we're going to try to touch on the factor that how man helps nature in many scientific ways. And the way I conduct sessions at Holden is that we'll present some material to you for the next 20 or 25 minutes, and then the last 20 minutes, we want open dialogue. We want to hear what questions you have and what you're interested in about this general subject. And I like to keep the keep it on a high tone because so many of us have read and learned so much about all this devastating things that are happening to the earth that for today, at least for a little while, we'd like to keep ourselves buoyed up a little bit. We've all heard of the miracle of birth in the human way, but we know that the advances in medicine have also been made in many other scientific areas. And in a few minutes, we're going to try to show you some of the advances in some of these scientific areas. Before I do that, I want to tell you one joke, because this gets really heavy around here at Holden. And I notice that people get kind of bogged down, so I keep a couple of stories in my background. But this one's about three guys I met here at Holden, one from New York and one from California and a fellow from Minnesota. So the three of them went on a long hike. And they, as luck would have it, they got lost. And I think they ended up somewhere in Canada on a devastated island, and they were there for weeks. And it was just terrible, and they were at the rope's end, and all of a sudden a genie appeared in front of them. The genie said, "You each get one wish, and whatever it is, it'll be granted." So the guy from California said, "Oh, to be back in San Francisco, top of the mart, and having a steak dinner," and he was back there. So the guy from Manhattan says, "I want to see my girlfriend in Manhattan," and wham. In a second, he was back in Manhattan. And the Minnesotan in the droll way said, "Man, it's sure lonely around here. I wish my friends were back." Now, there's one other one that you'll hear before you leave and stay here a week, and that's that St. Peter was checking all these people in at the pearly gates, and all of a sudden the computers backed down, and this huge crowd backed up, and there were people everywhere. In the front of the row were three Lutheran bishops. But when the computer got straightened out and everything, they went way to the back of the crowd there and found this woman and brought her up, and she entered the pearly gates, and these bishops objected. They said, "We've always led a good life on earth, and we think we deserve to be considered here," and everything. So who is that person anyhow? And St. Peter said, "She was a bus driver from Holden Village, and she scared the hell out of more people than all three of you put together." Well, science has moved by leaps and bounds, and the computer and space satellites have combined to give us a quantum advance, to give us tools and knowledge never before known to man. This is true in meteorology, water, soils, agriculture, space, and atmosphere. Wherever we look, we know that the scientific picture has changed and is moving ahead very rapidly. And so, to show you some of this, I'm going to show a little bit of a video here, and I got two of them. And I'm only going to show you 2 or 3 minutes, but I want to show you the type of thing that's being conducted these days for research.
Which one should we watch, Howard?
Pardon me? In your case, both of them.
Tornado, taped near Minneapolis, Minnesota, is a dramatic example of an atmospheric vortex. Wind speeds in these vertical vortices sometimes reach 200 miles an hour. They are usually spawned at the boundary between air masses of greatly differing temperatures. But whirlwinds or vortices are not only formed by contrasting air masses, they are also formed by wildland fires. Most whirlwinds caused by forest fires are small, vertical, and short-lived. Sometimes one becomes large and strong enough to do tornado-like damage to forests and structures. But even small vortices can cause problems in firefighting. Besides making fires burn faster, they pick up burning debris which they deposit outside the fire line, increasing spot fires. Some whirls are filled with hot and noxious gases. Others can collapse over the fire lines, endangering firefighters working the flanks.
Although there is little suppression forces can do to prevent or break up vortices in wildfires, we know some of the conditions under which they are likely to develop and the more favorable places within the fire area for them to appear. Armed with this knowledge, fireline supervisors can take precautions to provide for the safety of their crews and to minimize the effects of the world's on fire control.
That's the purpose of this tape, to tell you, as a member of an incident command system, what we've learned about vortices and wildfires, so you can forewarn your crews. Like tornadoes, vertical fire whirls have a rising current of unstable air that rotates in a narrow vortex and is fed by a continuous supply of buoyant air at the bottom. With a plastic chamber, you can create a laboratory fire whirl displaying the same characteristics as this whirl on an actual forest fire. The plastic has an opening along the length of the seam. Air enters the 1/2-inch space along its length and begins to spin inside the circular chamber. Lighter fluid in a small cup provides the fuel. Most vertical vortices, or whirls, are named according to where they are located in a fire. Some of the more common are the perimeter vortex, the hotspot vortex, the eddy vortex, the central core vortex, and the tornado twin vortex. Perimeter vortices can range from a mild swirl, like this one that developed during a California prescribed burn, to a very rapid swirl and can take on different shapes. Perimeter whirls often develop over hot spots along the flanks. At times, they appear to wander at random, sometimes crossing fire lines, scattering flaming brands here and there, and starting new fires. A hot spot vortex often is short-lived. The extreme turbulence in a hot fire may destroy the whirl soon after it's formed. But after the main fire has died away, the remaining hot spots can continue to be a source of whirls, the kind that often start new fires across the control lines.
As I told you, what we want to do here today is give you kind of a smorgasbord of suggestions about the type of research that's being conducted in the scientific world. This is one on forestry. Len has agreed to tell us somewhat of the work that's being done at the Los Alamos Laboratory for just a few minutes and give you some other suggestions about thoughts you can have of the type of work he is doing there as a scientist.
Let me have that move over here. In my expertise, we're studying fusion energy research, and so we're trying to develop a future energy source. And one of the things that is involved in fusion energy is temperatures and conditions, a lot of times, that are very close to that of stars. Millions of degrees, very high densities, a lot of times, like a lead ball weighing 16 pounds would weigh 1,600 pounds at some of the densities that we're talking about. So we're involved in fusion energy research. We're involved in fission energy research. We have a nuclear reactor at Los Alamos. We're involved in biology, because we're studying DNA, and one of the projects is to look at the DNA structure of and try to, what they call the genome project, trying to, what's the word, trying to, it's cataloging it, ordering it. We're involved in chemistry projects in the sense of trying to develop new materials for many different and variety of directions. And so, we're also involved in waste management, nuclear waste management, because of the fact that we are dealing with nuclear facilities there. And finally, we have an accelerator. We have an accelerator where we accelerate protons up to the speed of light and collide those with other materials. So we're studying properties of matter, particle physics, things in that realm. So you have biology, chemistry, physics, everything going on. There's 5,000 scientists there. And if you ever have a chance to come to Los Alamos, I would have you do that. It's a resource unlike probably any other place in the world.
Thank you, Glenn. 5,000 scientists impressed me that most of us have heard of Los Alamos, but we never thought of the scope and the magnitude of the research that's being conducted there. Rick, I'm going to call on you now to tell us a little bit about what is going on in the geology or geography or whatever you choose, and the update us a little bit.
Well, with respect to resources, the geological side of things, I think geologists in their history have often been called on to try and locate resources for our use. Energy resources, metallic ores, building materials, water, soil. A variety of resources have their origins in the geologic history of the Earth. And the thing I think that has changed most within the last few decades is the way that we interpret geologic history now. And the key part of that is the theory of what today we call plate tectonics, or what in the past has been called continental drift. And it's the understanding of the Earth as very dynamic, and that the Earth's crust is broken up into pieces that move around and change their positions throughout time. And this notion of a dynamic, moving crust changes completely the way that we interpret geologic history. And if we are to find resources as they're needed, we need to be able to find the circumstances under which those resources form. We need to be able to interpret the history of the Earth. And nowadays, the way that geologists go about interpreting Earth history is in terms of the history of those plate movements, trying to figure out what plates were where when different sediments were deposited, and how those sediments changed as the plates moved somewhere else, and what kind of energy resource or metallic resource was incorporated in the rock in the course of those movements. So if I, given what Howard told me to think about last night, the one thing that is really new about the geology is the way we think about how the Earth works. And that has been a true scientific revolution, and one that's taken place only since the late 1960s. So it really is only a few decades old, not even that, well, over two decades that we have this new understanding of how we think the Earth works.
Thank you very much. I was at a meeting not too long ago, and a person showed us some correlated computer printouts of satellite pictures of the corn crops throughout the United States. They had it color-coded so you could see which acreages were producing more than 100 bushels of corn per acre and which produced less. And he got this graphically in a matter of moments out of his computer, and they can get it daily if they want it. And it's correlated, of course, with the moisture content, the fertilization, the soil conditions, this type of thing. Most of the people in that audience were just amazed that such information was available. And the people in demographers and those that are studying world hunger, they thrive on this type of information. The state of Minnesota was one of the forerunners in developing computerized information on their natural resources. They have every cell, every 40-acre unit is a cell in the computer, and they can, in a matter of moments, tell what species are growing, what the soil type is, what the moisture content is, what the local population might amount to. And if you want to pick out a location for a new state park, you can do that in a matter of minutes, or take five or six logical places and make your selections later on. And the reason I bring this up is many people don't realize the extent that science has moved to. Most laymen go about their normal work and aren't aware that all of this scientific research and data is available and is being used every day and every week to help nature in her course. And it came to my mind that we say we're helping even though all this devastation is going on. But when we have things occurring that are what I call catastrophic, such as floods, earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, volcanic eruptions, many things that used to go unchanged, now because of our ability to forecast what might happen and to prepare ourselves and then to move quickly to repair the damage, we seem to be doing a much better job of helping nature than we ever have before. To illustrate this just a little bit now, I want to show you just about a minute on a tape on forest measurement. And after you've seen that tape, I want to tell you how it's done today compared to what it was done just a few years ago. And what you're going to see is partially obsolete now.
Right, and hopefully the most accurate age count possible. Click several counts and average them to get a good estimate of age, then measure total height. Using total height plus the estimate of tree age from the ring cut, you can determine site index from Carmine's published site index curves.
Well, just what site index should we have in a stand like this then, just to make it worthwhile to manage for good quality sawlog down the road?
Well, Russ, we should at least have a site index of 55 at age 50 for sugar maple, red maple, and yellow birch. Let's assume that this stand is 55 and worth managing for high-value products. Next, you need to determine the number of trees with a 10-factor prism. And while you're doing that, see how many good count trees per acre you have.
And then you would first would make several prism counts and in the stand to get the average basal area, right?
That's right. You would count the trees that were in, estimate their diameters the nearest 2 inches, and record them. Then using the expansion factor table, you would get the number of trees per acre. Yeah.
I think I could do that.
I think my dad could do something.
Now you can see how obsolete that is, but today we're going by satellite photos. We can determine the species of trees that are growing, what the density per acre is, and their health, their insect infestations, and many, many other things. It's just phenomenal, the amount of information we have now to help nature. In a few minutes, we're going to open this to dialogue. Before we do, I want to keep my lofty evaluation of nature. I got this card in the mail today. It says, God is in his own way, is at work in his own way. It's just arrived, and it quotes St. Francis of Assisi. It says, Assisi speaks to us today with a message of joy and inner peace, 800 years young, fresh and pure as a dawn, ever praising and thanking God for the particular wonders of his creation. Francis was a lover of sunlight, fire, water, wind, because they come from God and of the world he made. Of all the children of God, human beings, creatures, plants, sharing our common planetary home. And with that, before we begin our dialogue, I'm going to show you just a very short 2 minutes here on some of the problems that we are faced with in our natural resources and our national parks.
Howard, you left out a comma.
Okay.
Between fire and water.
Okay, fire, water.
Bring forth in the people. In other words, when you go to Yellowstone, it is the awe and the understanding of it, of geographic or geologic phenomena that is taking place, that takes place in very few places in the world, and so it's therefore unique. You shouldn't go there with the idea that there's going to be an afternoon horseback ride that you could have taken any place else in the country. So that we have to come back to saying that these are the special areas to be taken care of in a special way. That may mean that at some time, a system that regulates the amount of visitation at any one time, not to deny the public in totality, but it would say that you're going to try to make the kind of experience the public should have for every visitor and not cram every visitor in there and then have them destroy one another's experience.
The quickest way to do that, sir, in order to A, cut down pollution, and B, cut down the desire of some people to go to these parks, would be to ban or severely restrict access to private vehicles. In other words, get Americans out of that which they love most, which is the automobile. Should we go in that direction?
Certainly that is necessary in places that are confined, such as Yosemite Valley. There was a 1980 general management plan that said that that was the very thing that we should vote for. I would say that one of the unfortunate things was that the National Park Service, after 10 years of really not accomplishing very much, was almost willing to step back and say, well, it's too difficult to separate the American public from that automobile, and therefore we won't pursue that.
With Yosemite National Park so popular, so many people coming there every year, that just the management of the crowds, and as he said, the automobiles and everything, they have traffic jams that are unbelievable. They have gridlock every day, I guess. So with what we've shown you thus far now, I'd like to have you tell us of some questions you might have about natural resources and how you think the scientific community is relating to our natural resources in a manner to a system or not a system. And we've got these two experts you heard from, plus several others in the audience, so I'll rely on that. Al?
Hart, I'd like to get your views on whether or not we are keeping up with the tree growth population. You know, some time ago I used to watch a program that was sponsored by a Weyerhaeuser, and their motto is the tree growing people. And they would show you planting all these trees. Well, everybody knows they're the biggest timber company, and one of the biggest. And they never tell you how many trees they cut down, but they were always creating the image, we're the tree growing people, and I'm wondering if we're keeping up with the growth or the loss of trees, or are we staying even, or are we losing ground?
Well, there's a very there's a good way to show that, and it's quite deceptive in some manner. There's a method of saying what the growth per acre per year is in America, and they talk about the timber drain, and for many years we were cutting more than we were growing. Now we are growing more than we're cutting. New York State today has more standing square footage of lumber than it had 75 years ago. The only fallacy in that whole debate is that what we're growing are on small trees, and they're not, won't be ready for harvest for many, many, many years. So the statistics are true, but they leave a distorted picture, you might say.
Well said.
Yes.
What's your views on clear cutting?
Let's see.
And then they'll be playing with one species, which they seem to do, and something like that. Most of them, I understand, die, and like these little seedlings with no protection for them.
What did you call it?
Clear cutting.
Clear cutting.
Oh. I mean, you see that. It is, we're across the Cascades Highway the first time. It's all these sections of our national forest which have been cut down clear.
Yeah, the argument in favor of clear cutting goes to the species that need sunlight and can't be cut and grown, on. One of those species is Douglas fir. In Minnesota right now, they're doing a lot of clear cutting because they found out how to use aspen, which used to be our weed species, and suddenly we've got four huge new plants making fiberboard and wafer board. So they're clear cutting aspen, and you don't have to replant that because it's a root sprouter and grows very densely. In the West, it's a different story with clear cutting, where you're laying it out on the face of the mountain, everybody can see it. And but Douglas fir is a reason. It needs sunlight, and for it to be regenerated, they need the sun on it. And that's the technical reason they clear cut. But beyond that, there's economic reasons. It's a lot cheaper to log and what have you. My personal opinion has changed over the years. It's obvious we're going to have to quit cutting as much timber as we've been cutting, particularly in the Pacific Northwest.
And there are those that would want to ban the spotted owl to Africa.
Yeah.
Because that is a big thing now over on the coast.
This last one I showed you, that there's something in there on the spotted owl too that they're inquiring with the director. The director of the Department of the Interior was on there and talking about spotted owl. He was talking about 216,000 jobs. And that's a long debate of its own, it's been going on out here for a long time. Last year when I was here, we had the chief logging superintendent of Weyerhaeuser was in the audience, and we had some very good discussions. Yes?
Is there any kind of a formal organization of scientists that I don't know what capacity I serve in, but for instance, that's a lobby group it somehow gives political impetus to the scientific discoveries that they make. Or, I mean, we're so far behind in our political action in our scientific knowledge. So is there any formal organization that can kind of push that forward?
Well, there are. There's a lot of lobbying groups, you know, like the Forest Products Industries has their own group, going for more cutting and more privileges, more sale, more timber sales. The environmental groups, as a coalition, if you look at the amount of money they raise every year for their efforts, the environmental groups do have excess money over what the industry groups have, but they don't seem to get their story told as well or adhered to. But there's a great effort. I mean, those of you who have lived in Washington, D.C. know about that.
I might comment.
Yeah, I know about those. I guess I'm interested in the scientific. I mean, are you guys organized? Or?
Let's see. I might comment on that. In the United States, we have had a problem in going from the idea and prototype stage to industry. Part of the reason for that is that the industry has cut back on the amount of money that they put into research. And that's our fault, as I tried to illustrate in the last talk. The reason it's our fault is because we say that we want a certain amount for profits. And what you have to do is you have to take some of that money that would have been in the profit area and put it into research. Now, what we're doing at Los Alamos is to try to increase the relationship between industry and the laboratory, because the laboratory is a huge resource for the nation. All of our national laboratories are a huge resource. And so what they're doing now is what's called the technology transfer, in which the ideas that come from the laboratory, the prototypes that are developed, can be implemented into industry as quickly as possible. That is just starting. The reason for it is because there's so many legal issues associated with doing that, and we're trying to get through that right now. But that is beginning, and that is in fact talked about in the energy transfer technology section of the book that I talked about. That is the National Energy Strategy.
Didn't a group of scientists internationally meet with political figures about the ozone or the greenhouse? Sort of a lobbying effort?
Yes.
To our political, that's what I heard you ask.
Yeah, well, it is.
Well, that certainly, yeah, that is happening too. They met about the ozone layer problem, and before carbon problem was identified as a real issue. And we should still be concerned about that, because they felt at that time they agreed to cut back 35%. A lot of people feel that that's not enough, and that another meeting has to take place. And all of those issues, carbon dioxide use, nitrous oxide, you name it, as far as the air pollution is concerned, and water pollution, those are global issues now. And we need an international effort in those areas. And so that you should certainly support as much as you can.
I'd call your attention. There's a pamphlet here that's available, Saving the Ozone Layer. And then there's a very good book here from the Scientific American, Managing Planet Earth. And it has about 8 categories of topics on the very things we're talking about. The subject is so extensive that it's difficult to talk about it in a few moments. But there's a lot of good material available on each of these subjects. And I wanted to reply a little further in your question. I was president of an organization called the Forest Products Research Society, and all of that research, they publish a monthly journal, and that's the same thing, technology transfer over to industry where it can be utilized properly. And I think that's true. Most research is being done on a very extensive basis. The trick is to get the knowledge implemented into useful places where it'll be fully utilized.
See, I had a question for you, Howard.
Okay.
One of the things I became aware of fairly recently is the problem of managing wilderness areas, in the sense that if you protect the forest from fire, as was the policy for a long period of time,
you can build up a situation which is very dangerous, as occurred in Yellowstone, for example. And in fact, there's a situation like that on Orcas Island, I believe. I was there just recently, and that's a very dangerous place, I think, for fire. And possibly here also. What do you feel about doing?
Well, I guess the whole scientific, the Yellowstone fire, and you're all familiar with that, I'm sure, the scientific journals were just full of debates for 2 years after the fire, and some of it before, but those that said the management was wrong was to say that there was 50 years of a burnable buildup on the ground in Yellowstone, and they're the people that believe in backfires and management, forest management by controlled fire and controlled burning. And a lot of that's a normal thing of the Forest Service, controlled burning. The other factor that came up was the Park Service has a different philosophy of management than the Forest Service has, and one of them was what you read about there too, was the let burn. When the fire gets started, there are many, many hundreds and hundreds of lightning fires every year, and do you run to the fire and try to put it out, or do you let it take its normal course? And in the Yellowstone case, it got out of hand because there was so much fuel built up after 50 years of no burning control that it did get out of control. Now they've changed their management plans. They've dropped the let burn policy. For years, you could find in states like Minnesota where the state Forest Service could put out a fire much faster than the federal could, because certain on the wilderness areas, they wouldn't use bulldozers for fire control. They wouldn't use other mechanical means that the state would use, and they'd get a better record. There's always a big debate between the people that want more roadless areas and those that want access to wilderness areas for fire detection, fire suppression. So this debate goes on, and it probably will continue to. And I always get back to what you said this morning. We're all involved in all this, and it gets down to trade-offs. If you want a roadless area, you're not going to have quite the fire protection you've got with the road in there.
The ones that want the roadless area are not the ones that have to take care of it.
It depends on the care, right, Mark? I mean, if the care is one in which a fire occurs, as Howard was saying, you let it burn.
It isn't only fire, it's disease.
Yeah, disease.
Insect infestations. Right. Have to get at them. In Minnesota, we've got big demand for this aspen. We got very large stands of 80, 85-year-old aspen that are quite inaccessible. If we don't open them up, they'll be hit by fire, disease, and wind. A good windstorm will knock it all down. It'll decay and be gone. The industry wants to get in there and get it harvested properly and replant and regenerate it and utilize it. That's where we're at. And when you do cut there and clear cutting, you increase the deer population and the wildlife is better. The hunters like it and all that type of thing. So we got some good things going.
No, I've got some nasty things to say about clear cutting as a hunter.
Okay.
It's real messy. You can get yourself hurt in a real quick hurry up in those clear cuts. Because a lot of times they leave stumps and logs and branches and holes in the ground and everything else. That's dangerous. Go in those areas.
That's dangerous for a hunter, you mean?
Yeah. Even just getting through, even if you're not hunting, even if you're just trying to get from that through that area to another area of old growth to go camping or hiking or whatever, to go through that stuff is miserable.
I always have a thing I say to people that like wilderness. If they've ever truly been in a real wilderness area, many people, when they talk about wilderness, are thinking in their minds, I think, about a kind of a park-like atmosphere or something like around here. I worked for the Forest Service on the Olympic National Forest, and one day I got lost and I had to get my compass out and finally found myself, and it took hours and hours, and I was going cross-country through real wilderness and where you got blowdowns that are 5 feet in diameter and all this type of thing you have to contend with. You find out in a hurry what real, true wilderness is. And the scientific definition of wilderness is totally untrampled by anybody or anything, you see. So we've got a lot of things going in this country. Rudy, you want to make a couple comments about our discussion here today?
Yeah, I would, because I think that the problems now that we face are so large and so specific that the scientists pretty well know what really should be done in many areas, but it's a question of how that can be implemented, which you've indicated, and to me, it's a grassroots problem. It resolves itself to the point that I think Holden, you know, has an opportunity to do something about this. When we think of the fact that we bring in and out of here each year 5,000 to 6,000 people, and if we in some way can educate them to the long-range values of many of these things, because at the grassroots, whether it's political, whether it's economic, whatever you consider, it's a short-range look. And we cannot afford at this point in time, in my judgment, to be satisfied with a short-range look. And so if we can instill values that really can be promoted on a long-range basis, to me, that's what our program ought to be. And if in some way the science and technology people who come here can disseminate information that gets back to the churches, then we've got a broad base for doing something about this, because it now is the point where people, you can't just leave this to the experts. The experts can't handle it. So it's got to be the people at large.
Good. And you said just about what we're trying to do here today is stimulate all of you to think in these terms and to let you know a little more about what the scientific community is doing. But as Rudy says, when all of that is said and done, gets back to the population and the individual people and individuals. And I always say to people at Holden, gets back to our congregations and what we want to do as Christians, because we have a double feeling for all this. I want to finish today with just read a paragraph here that is taken from a speech that was given by Gro Brundtland, who was the Prime Minister of Norway and attended, she's a great environmentalist and attended a number of the international conferences on the environment. She said, when the 20th century began, neither human beings nor human technology had the power to radically alter the global ecosystem. Today, as the century draws to a close, human beings in ever-increasing numbers have that power, and as a result of their activity on the planet, major unintended changes are taking place in the atmosphere, the biosphere, and the hydrosphere. These changes outstrip our present ability to cope. The world's financial and political institutions are out of step with the workings of nature. And then she goes on and talks about poverty. But we've talked about this many times, that the politicians and the environment and the economy, it's all a combined trade-off now, and we're all in this together. And I thank all of you for being here today. I've enjoyed talking with you. That's the end of our session.